This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last Tuesday, we spent time talking about Opera Carolina's upcoming production of Bizet's The Pearl Fishers. That's a work from a different time. But opera isn't stuck in a time warp. There are new works being created for it that are of and about more modern times and situations. And one person who has contributed tremendously to that effort is our guest today, one of the foremost composers working in opera in America, South Carolina native Carlisle Floyd. From the time he came onto the scene in the 1950s, he has continually produced new works in every decade of the last century into this one. Operas based on everything from the apocryphal story of Susanna, set in the mountains of Tennessee, his first great work, to the seamy side of American politics with Willie Stark. Along the way, he had the vision to transform John Steinbeck's brutal yet tender novella of Mice and Men into a musical work, writing both the words and the music. It was a long and dusty road that led to triumph.
Soft and small and gray, its eyes were sharp and bright. It was what I want most in the world.
Lenny's aria from Carlisle Floyd's Of Mice and Men, as sung in the Houston Grand Opera production by one of our other guests this hour, four-time Grammy Award-winning tenor Anthony Dean Griffey. Mr. Floyd, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Charlotte, and also Mr. Griffey, nice to have you with us too. You're from North Carolina.
I am.
Well, welcome home.
Thank you.
We'll talk
Great
about
to
that
be here.
As we go through the program. Nice to have you with us. We're also joined by Dr. Jessie Wright Martin. She's Associate Director of Voice and Director of Opera at Wingate University. Good to have you with us this morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
It is Wingate, of course, that brought Mr. Floyd and Mr. Griffey to town as part of a residency program at the school. In addition to working with students, Mr. Griffey will be performing Friday at the university's Batt Center at 7:30. We have information on that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. And I'm told, you just told me this, that the students are performing a series of scenes from various Carlisle Floyd operas. You were at rehearsal yesterday, is that right?
I was there for about a half an hour. I heard two different segments.
That would have freaked me out if I were one of those students. How do they react to that?
Well, not noticeably freaked out. So, they probably were a little bit more tense than usual, but
yeah.
It was not apparent.
Behind the scenes, what was it like?
They were very excited, and they were very terrified.
Yeah, as you said off the air a minute ago, that was it's going to be a week of a once-in-a-lifetime moment, because it's very rare that students are going to get to meet with the composer and sing for him, in front of him. And I guess you're giving some sort of feedback to them about
yes.
their performances. Equally frightening.
Well, that's not my side of it, thank goodness.
U.S. Opera describes you, Mr. Floyd, as a neo-romantic Southerner. Is that an apt description, or is that correct?
Yeah, that's fairly accurate, I would say. I don't see anything really to disagree with in that. Romantic sort of pegs me into the 19th century, but certainly I think my music is traditional.
Yeah, that's why I asked, because when you listen to the music and look at some of the themes that you write about and the stories that you choose to tell, it's certainly not 19th century.
No.
And the way that you tell the story, musically you tell the stories, I'm sure that in its time, particularly in the 50s, you were breaking all kinds of new ground.
Well, I hope so.
Melodically and otherwise.
There were several of us who were trying to create a native American musical drama. Mm-hmm. And I think we all had pretty much the same aims in mind, which was to create something that was as absorbing for audiences as they were used to having in films or television,
right?
Which meant a different kind of approach to the libretto in terms of brevity and conciseness, and also using subjects that had some relevance to the audiences in this country.
And so, people have said that some of your music has Aaron Copland-like sounds in it. But if you're from that generation, that and some of the work
right.
that you've done is not unlike what Aaron Copland was trying to do symphonically, like Martha Graham was trying to do with dance.
Exactly. It all fits.
How do you explain that? Is that a generational thing? Is that something that—
I think it was a generational thing that started actually the generation before me.
Mm-hmm.
My teacher was very, very committed to American music and to the propagation of American opera, which, of course, was— to say it was in its infancy is really an exaggeration. There simply wasn't any mm-hmm. American opera as such before the beginning of the 1950s. And so it was new territory, uncharted. But we, as I said earlier, we knew what we wanted to achieve. And certainly with the idea of it's becoming an art form for a much larger audience than presently existed.
When you think about American music with 60 years vantage point, I think we can all understand the difference in the way it sounds versus the way European opera sounded, or even European symphonic music, or even European popular music.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, when you were creating it, when there was none, what was American music in your mind?
Well, we had people like Aaron Copland break the ground for us in the previous generation
mm-hmm.
and create music that in his case, with his dance scores, involved interpolating American sounds and actually American music, which he did in the Appalachian Spring for Martha Graham, actually a hymn.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also in Rodeo, very strong folk elements. So we had a whole generation that, as I said, served as a guidepost for those of us who really wanted to take this further and mm-hmm. to take it into opera, because that's one thing Copland didn't try until Tender Land, which was actually done the year before My Susanna was done.
Mm.
But my teacher was, as I said, rather militantly American, as many of in the 30s were, which happens in every country when there's a breakaway from the mother lode, so to speak, and the attempt to create a native artwork. And we saw it in 19th century in Central Europe with people like Smetana. And even later than that, so this was our equivalent of doing that for the American public, to create something that could be understood and appreciated and responded to in a very American way. As I was saying, my teacher, as I said, was rather militant with that, and he actually forbade his composition students to use Italian tempo indications. But he wasn't the first, because Copland did the same thing. He would say, instead of allegro or whatever, he would say rough, tough, or fast, or But the whole idea was to do something mm-hmm. very cogent and very terse, which they somehow had the idea that that was America.
Were you allowed to use, I've forgotten the name of the term, when you were fortissimo?
You would just simply say loud.
Loud.
So or what's louder.
What's the abbreviation for that? Is it, it's not F. Is it L?
That of course, was an extreme that it went to, and my generation never really adopted that.
Okay.
Because, after all, Italian is the international musical language.
Right. You were born in Latta, South Carolina, a little while ago. How long did you live there?
Till I was 6 years old. And then my father went back to college to finish his degree and become an ordained minister.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, it was for the Methodist Church, and we did a great deal of traveling around the state of South Carolina, mm-hmm. and living in, I think, before I went to college, I think we lived in five different places. And then, of course, after that, he continued to move until he retired in his 80s. So that kind of peripatetic life was very much known to us.
You started out as a serious student of piano, and I know that your mother taught you for a while because she was a pianist. Can you remember the first time you touched a keyboard?
Not really, because I was 3 years old, and I may have touched it, but certainly with no knowledge or understanding of it. My mother was a pianist, and I simply wanted to do what she was doing because I liked the sounds. And she was going to teach me and actually got instruction manuals to teach young children. And gave me probably a lesson or two, and then I saw that there was work connected with it, and that was the end of my piano work until I was 10 years old, and then I begged for piano lessons again and was really ready the second time to make a go of it.
Which carried you through all the way to your musical education in Syracuse University. But at what point did you know that music would be your life or a big part of your life?
It was a toss-up because I was also interested in painting and in writing. But I won a scholarship to Converse College.
This is where I went awry yesterday. I was trying to do some research on you, and Wikipedia says that you went to Converse College. And I thought, well, I've got to disregard this entire article now, because Wikipedia can be wrong, and Converse College is a girls' school. There's no way he went to Converse College.
No.
But you did.
But the School of Music is co-ed.
Ah.
That's the, you know, and there were not many of us at that time, especially because the war was on.
Right.
But those of us who were there were, we were on campus students, but we didn't live on campus.
Right.
But we took classes on campus and did your practicing on campus and all the other things that students did. We just didn't sleep on campus.
And you went to you got a scholarship there.
Yes, and that determined which direction I was going in, because it was at that point I wasn't that committed to any one art form.
Is that where you met your teacher Ernst Bacon?
I certainly did. Yes,
and you followed him to Syracuse.
Yes, he invited me to come to Syracuse when he took over the directorship of the school there.
Our guest today, Carlisle Floyd, composer of many operas through the beginning in the 1950s to the present day. Also with us, Anthony Dean Griffey and Dr. Jesse Wright Martin. We're coming right back. We'll talk to them as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Creative Loafing, announcing the first annual Iron Fork event tomorrow, April 17th. Five local chefs compete for the Golden Fork Award. More at clclt.com/ironfork2013. Tomorrow it's a dash of art with a dash of science. North Carolina native and New York Times bestselling author Ron Rash will be here. One of his novels, Serena, is being made into a movie with Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper, due out in December. And he's going to talk about that experience, the experience of turning a novel into a movie, and about his works as well. And then we turn our focus to the science and the upcoming UNC Charlotte Science and Technology Expo. That's all tomorrow at 9.
Each day, All Things Considered brings you unparalleled insight into the latest news. We interview experts who have deep knowledge on topics of the day, who have the skills to explain. We unravel complex issues that sometimes seem too hard to grasp. I'm Melissa Block. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News. Your appointment with excellence.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Carlisle Floyd today, composer of Susanna, of Mice and Men, Willie Stark, Cold Sassy Tree. I could go on, but the show's only an hour. Dr. Jesse Wright Martin is also with us from Wingate University. They have brought Mr. Floyd to town, along with four-time Grammy-winning tenor Anthony Dean Griffey, who is also in our studio sitting very patiently waiting for a question. I will get to you, I promise. Thank you all again for being here. I'm just curious, because you have said that you, I think, were never an opera fan. And really didn't go into music thinking that you would become a composer or composer of opera. And you grew up in South Carolina where, let's be honest here, there aren't a lot of opera houses.
There still aren't.
So what made you go in that direction? You grew up at a time and you were influenced at a time when American music was probably at its zenith. We're talking about people who are writing incredible Broadway shows and Broadway musicals. The songs from Broadway musicals became part of the popular culture unlike today. Great American Songbook was being written by pop composers around the country, particularly out of New York and Tin Pan Alley. And you decided to go into opera. Why?
Well, I had to do some thought about this because when I had the success of Susanna, I got that question over and over again. You don't have any operatic background. Certainly nobody in your family wrote operas or even knew what it was, probably. And I can only say that it was a way of combining my various interests because I never thought about becoming a symphonic composer. That didn't interest me at all. But being a theater composer interested me tremendously. And also it was a time in which this burgeoning movement towards an American culture, native culture, was in the air. That was very intoxicating too. So I wanted to be a part of it. And I felt that there was a very large untapped audience for American music and especially American opera, that if we could deliver the right kind of operas, that audience would respond and end up coming to opera. And I'm happy to say I've lived long enough to see that happen, because the number of opera companies has just proliferated incredibly in this country. There were three when I began that could have given my work its launching. And the only one that did it, of course, and would have, was the New York City Opera. Mm-hmm.
Because the Metropolitan Opera was very, Metropolitan Opera was involved in
Europe. Metropolitan and San Francisco were the other two.
Right.
But now we have probably, I would say, 25 operas of that caliber that could launch a new work.
I'd like to hear from the other two people about that, because you're saying that in the last 30 years,
certainly since 1980 in the introduction of surtitles,
that opera has exploded and in America. And I'm curious as to why you think that is, because symphonies are having a tough go of it right now, and opera seems to be going in the opposite direction. Why do you think that is? You perform all over the world on stages in opera, Mr. Griffey.
I do. I think the reason for that is the starting of surtitles, and that I've always felt I did not, as Carlisle did, I did not grow up with the opera. It was brought to me through my music education, but it combined my love of theater and of singing. I'm primarily known for singing in English and singing Carlisle's operas, works primarily of Mice and Men, but I've sung, Peter Grimes and several other American operas. And I think it's just that that it's in the language of the people, they understand it. And that opera was really created for all people, not just a select group of people. I do a lot of work in the public schools and take opera into the public schools. And if you go into the public schools, and sing for children, and I sing with my voice, I don't scale it down any really, they're so attentive. They love it. It's just a unique sound that they've never heard before.
Right.
And my little nephews, who are 7 and 10, you know, they've just grown up with knowing their uncle's an opera singer, and they've seen me, you know, several times on PBS, and they're fans of it. They asked me actually to put on opera when I'm in my car. So that just thrills my soul. I mean, I think it's this, you know, coming of age that we've released the stereotypes that it's an elite art form. It's meant for all people.
Mm-hmm. I can remember the first time I saw a comic opera with surtitles. And it was shocking to me that it was funny.
Right.
And that people were laughing during it because they could understand it. It was shocking. I'd never heard laughter in an opera before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I guess it, you realize, hey, this is relevant.
Right.
And that's what is that the secret that people have found out because they can understand it, that it's relevant? Is that what attracts your students to it?
I think so, absolutely. And I also think that students are hungry to learn. And we bring students to Wingate for school shows. Mm-hmm. And most of these students have never seen anything like that. And they sit there for 2.5 hours and are thrilled.
Well, it's very different from what you see here on the radio these days or what you get on iTunes. So when they hear it, I would think that the first 30 minutes, it's like going to Shakespeare. The first 30 minutes, you have to get your ear tuned to the language. Then it must be fairly jarring for them. What is this?
But that's exciting.
Yeah.
You know, I think that when people are young, they're open to change much more than when we get older and set in our ways.
Tell me about it.
So they're just ready for anything we have to offer.
You were born in High Point.
That's correct.
North Carolina. And also, there are not a lot of opera houses.
Opera houses in High Point. No, both my parents were known for our furniture capital of the world. So both my parents were very hard furniture factory workers.
Really?
So I started singing in church when I was around the age of 5 at the First Baptist Church in High Point. Mm-hmm. And we had wonderful church music. I had a great organist at my church who gave me free piano lessons. And I was really pursuing a career as a minister of music in a church. I decided to go to Wingate. And my degree was in church music from there and planned on going to seminary. And it was not until my senior year that I realized I'd even visited Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. I'd won a voice competition, the state and the regional National Association of Teachers of Singing, and one of the teachers from Eastman said, "You really should consider coming to Eastman." And that's where I really felt my calling, true calling was in performance. And in those days at Wingate, we did not have an opera department. We had a very small music department, which was great in music education and church music. So, but I went to Eastman School of Music and received a master's degree there in vocal performance and literature. And then I met Renee Fleming and Rita Shane, who were both students of Beverly Johnson at the Juilliard School. So then I went to Juilliard and got a postgraduate degree. And I met Mrs. Johnson, who was my teacher at Juilliard when she was 86. And she was like a 16-year-old girl. She immediately took me to the Metropolitan Opera and had me sing for the artistic administration there, Maestro Levine. They wanted me to work on some different repertoire. I came back after finishing my degree at Juilliard a year later and started off with "It Must Make the Good Lord Sad" by Carlisle Floyd, my friend here from Susanna. And it was something, an aria that spoke to me immediately. Mm-hmm. And I started off with that aria, then I sang a couple others, and then I immediately was accepted into the Metropolitan Opera Young Artist Program.
I don't know what it is about tenors or sopranos, but there seems to be something special about them both. Maybe it's the excitement of those high notes. When did you know you could produce those sounds?
It was really when I went to New York. I didn't have a lot of self-confidence or self-esteem. I mean, because as you know, I grew up in High Point. I knew I had a voice, but I didn't know to what degree, you know, I would achieve this. So it was, you know, I started at the Metropolitan Opera in 1995 as a young artist, and I was an apprentice there for 3 years. And the first year there, I did a recording of E. Lombardi with Pavarotti. You know, I was made my Met debut in Parsifal with Placido Domingo. So over those things are an overwhelming experience for a young singer.
Yes, that's it.
And then I went on to sing Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. I sang Sam opposite Renee Fleming and Samuel Ramey as Olin Blitch at the Metropolitan Opera.
I have to stop you. What is that like for somebody who grew up in High Point to be on the Metropolitan Opera stage with these people who are world-renowned and with justification? And here you are, a young man, no self-confidence or little self-confidence, breaking out of your shell, essentially. What is that like?
You know, I have this little motto that I say to myself, and I've done some teaching, so I always have this thing, sing to express, not to impress. And so I kept saying that to myself. And, you know, I had such a wonderful teacher at Juilliard, Beverly Johnson. I worked with her for 9 years. She was Renee Fleming's teacher and Renata Tibaldi and Mignon Dunn, Anna Moffa, the list goes on and on, who she worked with. And she really just kept emphasizing to me to be myself, to take all the experiences coming from High Point, what I had, you know, grown up in the church, what I'd learned at Eastman, what I learned at Juilliard, and just be yourself.
That's the hardest thing in the world to do.
It is.
It is.
But I was very good at taking on other characters.
Yes.
And because I'd had all kinds of experience doing that.
Yeah, but because as a singer in opera, you are playing a character. You're not playing yourself.
Right.
To be yourself and to be the character at the same time and to bring what you as a human being can bring to that character, it sounds easy. It is not easy. It's the hardest thing in the world.
It is. It, at that time, and, you know, I've grown to realize I'm not a singer 24/7. You know, I am a singer. I do that for a profession. But I'm not that 24/7. I had to find other outlets.
Right. And plus the fact you're singing in opera, and there are so many expectations of opera singers. The audience expects something. They expect what they expect.
Right.
Out of a person singing a role. And if you're going to bring yourself to the party, that may not be what they're expecting.
Right. But the main thing is, you know, we had these great singers, Pavarotti, Domingo. I'm Anthony Dean Griffey, Tony Griffey. So it's important to be yourself. The world wants the next best you, not a carbon copy. You know, when I was a student, I'd listen to all these great recordings of Bierling and Domingo and the Geda, and the list goes on and on. And my teacher at Juilliard would say, oh, you've been listening to Geda. Oh, you've been listening to Bierling. I want to hear Tony. Let's hear Tony. And so I had to really find and carve out my own niche in this world of opera.
How'd you do it? Because that's the other thing I know from personal experience is that when you first start to get into something, into a career or a career path, you're there because you're attracted to it, and you're attracted to it probably because of the people who came before.
Right.
And so you try on all of their clothes to see what works for you, and you realize quickly, well, that doesn't work. You take that jacket off. At some point, you have to be naked and say, this is me.
Right. And I started that in a very difficult way. My first role were two of the biggest acting, singing roles that I know of. I started as Peter Grimes in a student production in 1996 with Seiji Ozawa for the 50th anniversary of the American premiere. The second major role I sang was Lenny in Of Mice and Men. So you can't get any more difficult than those two. They're really singing, acting roles. You know, I was never the type of singer that, you know, we call it, you know, park and bark. I was never that kind of singer. I'm an actor who sings and a singer who acts. So I was attracted to these roles because I thought I could bring something different to the roles.
You should explain. Park and bark is where you stand and sing.
Exactly.
And a lot of opera singers are adamant about doing just that.
Right.
The acting, you're telling a story, but the voice comes first. And if I move or do anything that causes me to disturb the voice, that's the wrong thing to do. And you've taken the other path.
Right. And that's what we were talking about earlier. I think that's what is bringing opera to life. You know, I happened to be a part of the HD broadcast of the Metropolitan Opera. I sang Peter Grimes
live. Across the country.
Yeah, across the world.
Across the world, yes.
Yeah, 500 movie theaters, 500 movie theaters. And it was there that Bruce Beresford, the famed film director who directed Driving Miss Daisy, heard me in Australia sing Peter Grimes and wrote in the Australian newspaper that he was looking for Anthony Dean Griffey to sing Lenny and Of Mice and Men at the Sydney Opera House. Well, I happened to have Google alerts and my name popped up and I read Bruce Beresford, Anthony Dean Griffey, Of Mice and Men. So I had my manager call his manager, so she couldn't find his manager. And so I called his Hollywood manager and said, I'm Anthony Dean Griffey. Bruce Beresford's looking for me to sing Lenny and Of Mice and Men at the Sydney Opera House. So then Bruce and I started talking and hooked up, and he called me, just a wonderful gentleman. So last year I had the great fortune of singing the premiere of Mice and Men in Australia at the Sydney Opera House, and then it went on to Melbourne, Australia.
Someday we're going to get some people of accomplishment on this program. I don't know when that's coming, but someday it's going to happen. But I have three educators sitting at the table, because in addition to being a composer of some of America's most amazing operas, you have been teaching for almost your entire career. After you graduated from Syracuse, you went to Florida State.
I was 21,
yes. And I'm told that in addition, you were very young. You were 21 and just able to teach under Florida law.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm told that one of the first courses that you taught was dealing with the problems of relating music and text in the composition of opera. You had not set out to... You hadn't written any operas yet. You had not set out to write opera. How did you know to teach? How did you know how to teach that?
I don't remember ever teaching that.
Okay, well,
but
then.
I certainly was concerned with it, but I did a one-act opera when I was a graduate student.
Okay.
And so, but I was writing at the same time, so I started something that I've continued through my career, of writing my own librettos.
Yes, not many people do that, and you've described that as an extremely difficult and rigorous discipline.
That's right.
Why do you do it?
Because it's it's never been examined that closely. In other words, what constitutes an opera libretto? What makes good opera material? And there's a very definite kind of grocery list of what you look for in opera material.
And on that list would be?
What's that?
On that list would be?
Certainly the idea that you're looking for action and passion, not speech, not talk. Puccini is credited with saying that a good libretto should be able to be understood by a deaf person. That's a little extreme, but it's basically true. In other words, the action should be able to be objectified to a point that the audience can follow it even if they don't know all the words.
Okay.
And, of course, with the addition of super titles now, it's eliminated all reason for not understanding what's happening on the stage.
And crisis is important.
Crisis is absolutely – it's the first thing I look for. Is there a crisis here? Because it's not just the action from one day to the next, or two old ladies getting over their coffee over a morning table. So, no.
We're going to come back.
That's definitely it.
We're going to come back and talk more about that with Carlisle Floyd, also with Anthony Dean Griffey and Dr. Jesse Wright Martin from Wynyard University. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Kenan Flagler Business School. The newly redesigned executive MBA evening and weekend programs can provide a balanced business education for today's professionals. emba.unc.edu. And Opera Carolina, performing Bizet's The Pearl Fishers this Thursday and Sunday at the Belk Theater. For more information, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. On the day of the Boston Marathon, explosions rocked the city, an update on casualties and what authorities know and how the nation is reacting coming up in 20 minutes at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you would like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
No matter where you live, no matter how you spend your day, the experiences you have listening to Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, become a part of your life. Our correspondents circle the globe Meet people you'd never otherwise meet and introduce them to you. It's like you're traveling with us. Come along on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen for Morning Edition starting at 5, weekdays on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, opera composer Carlisle Floyd, also with us, four-time Grammy-winning tenor Anthony Dean Griffey, and Dr. Jesse Wright Martin, who's the Associate Director of Voice and the Director of Opera at Wingate University. Both Mr. Griffey and Carlisle Floyd are teaching master classes at Wingate this week, and also Mr. Griffey is singing on Friday night, 7:30, in the Batt Center at Wingate University, along with, is he part of the production with the students?
Yes, he'll be singing with students and faculty.
And they're singing scenes from Carlisle Floyd's various operas. It'll be a nerve-wracking evening for the students, but fun for everybody involved. I'm certain of that. I'm not going to ask you the question, which comes first, the music or the lyrics? Because I know that you write your own librettos, and you write them first.
Yes.
And when you write them, you're not thinking about music.
Mm-mm.
But you are thinking about opera and how words function in the form, correct?
Yes.
And how do they function in the form? Because you have recitative and you have aria.
First thing you have to keep reminding yourself of is brevity. You know, Verdi asked for 7 syllables a line, no more. And if you get caught in one of these long run-on sentences, you're just dead, because in singing, the slowness of singing, you forget the first part of the sentence, but you get to the last. You know, so terseness is certainly one of the first mainstays, I mean, first commands of a good libretto. And just to go through, a stage play and try to reduce it to a libretto was a good exercise. In terms of conciseness,
but how do you know what is aria and what is recitative?
Recitative is for information. Aria is for expansion of emotion.
So the two are not really the same. In musical comedy parlance, aria is the big number, and recitative is the dialogue leading up.
Yeah, dialogue and music.
You sing in a musical when words do not suffice.
You know, the point is that it's been this way since the beginning of opera.
Yeah.
The recitative or the dialogue furthers the drama, carries you forward in the narration.
But you occasionally use spoken words.
What is that?
You occasionally use spoken words.
Oh, I definitely use spoken words, yes.
How did that go?
Use it just in the opposite way that they're used in a play.
Mm-hmm.
If I want something highly dramatic and it's a very important plot point, I'll probably set it to be spoken.
So when does
spoken on pitch?
When does the music come into all of this? And do you sometimes revise the words because you have a melody come into your mind that doesn't necessarily fit the words? How does it all come together, I guess, is the question.
By work?
Arduous work, no doubt.
Well, you have to be very, very aware of where you are. In other words, is this scene for information? Is it a character scene? Is it an action scene? And when you first start doing this, you make conscious choices. Now, when you are fairly experienced, these things happen almost automatically. You wouldn't think of an action scene setting it, say, at a very slow tempo. The point is, an action scene moves very quickly, and it's a different kind of music. Verdi is credited with saying, "We don't have time to stop here and sing," and I love that. Because that means the drama is propelling you forward, you know.
Yeah.
But that's also very instructive.
Yeah.
And much of what he said was instructive, for that matter.
When do you decide that Lenny has to be a tenor?
Right from the beginning. Because I was going to treat Lenny as a child, as a young boy. Who was simply limited mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Lenny has frequently been played as a slack-jawed idiot, you know, which I find repellent. and totally wrong. He's a human being whose mental growth stopped at a certain age. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I got that, George constantly refers to him as he's just a big kid.
George is his partner, yes.
George, his partner, yeah. And that gave me my cue as to how I could write music for him.
Okay.
And so he has an aria very early on in the first scene in which George is saying, "Why do you want to pick up a dead mouse?" And he says, "I like things I can touch and stroke." So it's my one chance to make the audience love Lenny and to understand why George stays with him.
Yeah.
And so if you see Tony Griffey do it, you fall in love with that character
Now, this was a novella by John Steinbeck, and I'm told that you wrote it and then discarded most of the first act after you played it for a couple of people that you respected.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just—it was too big. It was too long. It
was—it gotten completely out of control. I mean, it was getting like Ghetto Dameron, you know. and here it's a very concise novel, which I wanted to duplicate in the opera, and which ultimately I did with the second.
How difficult is it to trash years' worth of work and just say that's not working? We're going to rewrite the musical, rewrite the libretto. Everything's gone.
It's not as hard as you think if you know it's not working. And I had some of my closest friends say, "Well, Carlisle, it's just boring." Especially
wow.
My wife.
Those are okay.
And
I'm sitting behind me.
That's the one unpardonable sin in opera is to be boring. And the point is that many people think they can go to the opera and have a nap, and they frequently do with traditional opera. But not for American opera.
We've been talking a lot of Mice and Men for obvious reasons because Anthony Dean Griffey is sitting here and he's known for singing the role of Lenny. But you came onto the scene with your third opera, Susanna, in 1953, 55, somewhere in there.
55.
And it was a resounding success. Did that success surprise you, and how did it change your life?
Well, it changed my life radically. It launched my career, I mean, as an opera composer, because it was covered nationally. Time magazine devoted an entire page to it.
Mm-hmm.
And with that kind of publicity, you are launched. That changed everything, because a commission from Santa Fe followed very quickly for a second opera. And since then, there's been one commission after the other, I'm happy to say.
Yeah.
And I wrote one opera on spec. but that was as a gift to my dear friend Norman Traigle, who did the original Blitch in New York. And I wrote a one-act opera for him.
Well, I'm going to hear a bit of Susanna with Phyllis Curtin, who is the woman who created Susanna, singing in the title role. Now, that's a live recording of the New Orleans Opera in 1962. You approached her, Phyllis Curtin, in the 50s, I believe, with this opera. And after you played it for her, she worked tirelessly to get someone to produce this. Talk about that. Why was she so enamored of this work?
Well, she believed in it very much as a piece of musical theater from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I went to see her, I was astonished, because here I was a kid out of nowhere who just called in her and said I had an opera I would like for her to hear.
And she said, "Come on over."
She said, "Come on over." So I did. And I played her the two arias. And I said, well, I'll be glad to play you the entire opera. She says, I don't need to hear any more. And since then we started talking about it. She loved the idea of the libretto because it had a personal kind of resonance for her. Mm-hmm. Because she had made a very big hit in New York doing Salome at the City Opera. And there was a big pictorial coverage in Life magazine at the time, and she was denounced from her pulpit in her native West Virginia for having done this quasi-striptease on the stage with the Dance of the Seven Veils.
Right.
So she felt very akin to Susanna being falsely accused. But she recognized, at least from her standpoint, the virtues of the piece, and she thought it would be a very successful musical and dramatic experience.
And she changed your life.
Yes.
That's amazing, isn't it? When you think about one person coming into your life.
No, absolutely.
By happenstance, because she very likely could have said, I'm not going to see you. I don't know who you are.
No, she had the contacts in New York. And then after it succeeded in Tallahassee with a university symphony and the university orchestra, she was determined it was going to be heard in New York. And we started auditioning it for the producers, mm-hmm. for NBC Opera, which was in existence at that time, and also at New York City Opera. But it was initially turned down by them. Mm-hmm. And then they got a new general director for the fall, a very famous conductor, who did take it as part of the repertory of the fall season. But she sang everything. She sang all the roles or the chorus parts and anything to make it convincing.
Wow. Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of very quick phone calls here before we run out of time. And we'll begin with Houston in Charlotte. Go ahead. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I got to attend the world premiere of Willie Stark in Charlotte some years back, right? And I've been an opera fan and a theater fan for a long time, and that was probably the most exciting piece of theater that I've seen in my life.
Yeah, Willie Stark is amazing.
Yeah, and everybody knows what's going to happen at the end of the piece, but when he came around the corner with a gun in his hand, my heart was just racing. It was terrific.
That's wonderful to hear. I remember that production very well because I staged it. And
yeah, I got to meet you, but yeah.
But it was an excellent production, so I'm glad you saw a good version of it. And as I said, I remember that very vividly.
Okay.
And I'm glad you felt that way about the final scene because – of course, you know with the story what's going to happen in the final scene, but it's a question of how you get there. Yeah. And that's what keeps the suspense high.
You do direct your own operas, and you've directed other people's operas. Where did you learn how to do that?
By doing it. You can only read so much in the books, which I did.
Right.
But the rest of it is I think, a talent like any other.
Yeah.
If you know the basics, the strong parts of the stage, the weak parts of the stage, and how to coach singers to cheat and sing downstage while they're turned half-turn, and, you know, all those things are just practical. But it takes an eye for the stage and also a love of dealing with actors.
You have to understand the human voice to write opera and to be able to successfully sing it. Obviously, he understands tenors because you are known for singing a lot of Carlisle Floyd's work. You're also known for singing Benjamin Britten. You've also worked with Andre Previn, who most people know as a jazz pianist, and the husband of who
is he? Mia Farrow.
But he's also a serious music composer.
Yes.
And he's written something for you. He wrote four.
He wrote four songs, and then I did the world premiere of his opera, Streetcar Named Desire, which I just sang about 4 weeks ago at Carnegie Hall, and then just finished up a run last week at Lyric Opera of Chicago.
Mm. To write a good tenor role, what does that require?
I think it requires an understanding of the tenor voice, which is a strange instrument. It's not the most natural, I think, of the four voice types. And Carlisle does it so beautifully. A lot of people think I created the role of Lenny. Actually, I did not. I came to it in 1997. But it's had this huge renaissance, which I'm so thankful for.
Hmm. You are back at Wingate,
yes.
A school you attended. You're conducting master classes. I guess this is kind of like a homecoming for you. What's it like to go back to a school that you attended when you didn't, when you were nobody, and you didn't know you were going to be somebody, and now you are somebody, and you are the guy?
Well, I had the great support of teachers at Wingate when I was a student there. Gave me a really secure foundation musically and emotionally. Mm. So I've stayed connected since I graduated from there in 1990. So I've stayed connected with them throughout my whole career.
This strikes me as a coup for Wingate, Dr. Martin, because you have not only Anthony Dean Griffey coming back, but you have Carlisle Floyd to work with these students. What ultimately in their lives, what will this mean to these young people?
Well, it's an experience they're never going to be able to duplicate. As soon as I was hired at Wingate and I found out about Anthony Dean Griffey, I immediately reached out to him and have worked really hard to bring him back as many times as he's willing to come. And he suggested bringing Carlisle Floyd, and we're all going to remember this, and it's going to be the highlight of most of our lives.
I want to read an email from Ed before I run out of time. Ed writes, "Please tell Mr. Floyd that I enjoy playing his episodes for solo piano, and I hope that he will write more solo piano music." So something to do in your spare time.
That's a pleasure to hear that. Thank you.
Carlisle Floyd, one of the foremost composers of American opera with us, along with Anthony Dean Griffey, four-time Grammy-winning tenor, and Dr. Jesse Wright Martin, Associate Director of Voice and Director of Opera at Wingate University. This should be a two-hour show, because I've only scratched the surface of what I want to ask you, but time's up. Thank you.